This is tape recording number 6001, CO7, HCS7. The seventh lecture of the HCS course series, given by L. Ron Hubbard on the 7th of January, 1960. The title of this lecture is Inability to Withhold. It is 60 minutes long. Copyright 1960 by L. Ron Hubbard. Allwell performance rights reserved. This recording has been re-recorded by HCO Tape Section, St. Hill Manor, East Grinstead, Sussex, England.
Thank you.
Now, as you realize, there's a plot against you. Those of you who are in this course, and those of you who are in HCA, you've got to know more before the plot's against you. Now, what we're teaching at the HCS-BSCN level is actually inadequate as a basic instruction. You have to know how to audit before you can do this sort of thing. See? So, those of you who are in HCA, well, don't get too giddy. You just go right on and learn those processes you've got because they're hot too, you know. Actually, there's six fundamental processes. And if an auditor doesn't know those six fundamental process forms, why, he's had it. Because sooner or later, he's going to run one or another of them, regardless of what theory they're against. They've been around for quite a while. And the HPA-HCA course, which was taught in London by myself and Dick and Jan and so on, is still a standard HCA-HPA data. If you haven't got that, you have nothing. Now, when we go into higher levels of the thing, it's actually how you apply this data. Well, that doesn't mean you can't learn about this. It doesn't mean that you won't see some use of this. Now, I've been tearing up cases here with great glee. Great relief to be able to rip up cases fairly rapidly after 10 years. Now, cases were ripping up all right, but they were ripping up slowly. They were ripping up actually with a little higher level of genius than we have to use right now, because we know what's holding the case down. We know who is holding the case down. Actually, we didn't know that until recently, absolutely certainly. The person that's holding the case down is the case person. The person who has the case is holding the case down. That's the person that's doing it. And the reason he's holding it down, we know that. The reason he's holding it down is because he has lost his ability to withhold. That's the only reason he's holding it down, you see. He knows he's liable to do the doggondest things, and if he can't withhold these things, well, of course, he's had it. You get the idea? Well, that will become vividly clear to you when you walk into a life as a magician and find out that you just couldn't resist blowing up villages. Just couldn't resist hexing villages. And your difficulties then were how to cut yourself down and knock out your magic. See, that became the main problem. Is how to reduce your ability so you wouldn't blow up villages. Because you found out you couldn't stop blowing up villages. You know, you'd be walking down the road and you're feeling all right, and it's a beautiful spring day, and the girls that you've got in the dungeons are perfectly agreeable, and everything is going along fine. And you see a village, and you say, well, I can take it, leave it alone, you know, and you're very happy about the whole thing, and take it or leave it alone. Walk down past the outskirts of the thing, and somehow or another, you kind of stop against the stone wall, and you look at it, and you suddenly realize you're going to do it. And you do it. Well, there's only one real answer to that. If you couldn't stop yourself from blowing up the village, you can certainly lose the ability to blow up villages. One or the other will be the answer. Ability will not be regained by a preclear until he has rehabilitated his ability to withhold. Now, it isn't that we're a ready bunch of alcoholics, but the same mechanism goes on all dynamics. And we're familiar with that mechanism because it's in plain sight, it's been advertised, people have been propagandized with it, people have been degraded with it, the government gets a big tax from it. The alcoholic says, well, he's going to leave it alone. But what the alcoholic can't do is take one drink and stop. That's what he can't do. If you want to establish whether or not an alcoholic has been cured, it isn't whether he leaves liquor alone. He hasn't been cured if he merely leaves liquor alone. He's merely rehabilitated a total ability to abstain. Got the idea? He's got the ability to abstain, and he's recovered an ability to totally withhold himself from that, and that's what he's going to do. But that doesn't mean he has any control over the situation, does it? The way you test an alcoholic is to find out whether he can take one drink and stop. Put a bottle on the table, put a glass, fill up the glass, leave the bottle right there in front of him, and say, let's see if you can take one drink. If you come back and the bottle is empty, he isn't cured. Not only will that bottle be emptied, you see, but he'll be out ravening around the neighborhood trying to do anything he can do in order to get another bottle. And if left to his own devices, he would simply kill himself with it, because that also is a method of stopping. Probably this is the mechanism of death. Haven't investigated that too steeply or deeply. But that's probably why people die from poison and die from this and die from that. By the way, any stimulant taken in sufficient quantity is poison, and any poison taken in slight enough quantity is a stimulant or depressant. It's order of magnitude is the whole thing, just order of magnitude. There were some people around taking arsenic a few hundred years ago, for instance. Most of the witches had got a very bad repute, and they started driving stakes through their chests and all that sort of thing simply because they were arsenic takers. And they were taking arsenic, and it would, of course, preserve them against rotting. And you'd open up a coffin of somebody who was a reputed witch, and they wouldn't have decayed one single bit. The bacteria would bite and kick over because of the arsenic. And these people could condition themselves by small dosages, carrying it up to larger dosages, to a point where they could take enormous quantities of arsenic. This was first done to proof oneself against being poisoned, when arsenic was the favorite poison. And there was not necessarily a big zing involved with it, but there is a little bit of a zing involved with it. I know I tried it once, and didn't mix up one dose particularly, and particularly well, and didn't go on a proper gradient, and for a day or two, it was pretty grim. So I stopped that particular experiment at that point. I found out I could withhold. But I did find out this. I wanted to know if this story was true, and human beings on this particular planet aren't expendable, and I am. So there it is. And I wanted to find out whether or not you could take a gradient scale of this sort of thing, or what was the actual nature of poisons or stimulants. What was their actual nature? And I knew about this arsenic gag, and so I just started building up along the line. And it's true. It's true. There's a little bit of a zing to arsenic if you don't take quite enough of it. But I had already built myself up to a much larger than lethal dose at the time I slipped and took about double dosage. And therefore, somebody slipping arsenic into the oatmeal wouldn't have had any effect on me at all. But more importantly, much more importantly, the magic bullet. You remember the magic bullet, Ehrlich's magic bullet, 606, back at the turn of the 20th century, so forth, is nothing more nor less than that witch's cure brought up to present time. It's arsenic. And therefore, a witch didn't get sick, and they could handle some of the most fantastic diseases. They could handle black plague, you see, and they could handle smallpox, and they could handle anything under the sun. The witchcraft, by the way, was a very widespread organization that operated as the medical fraternity of Europe prior to the ingress of the Catholic Church with its talk about demons and how all thetans must die. And it's not that I was particularly a member of the witchcraft or a member of the church. But this was the big contest. And now the witchcraft has won out, except they call them MDs. They actually abused their privileges enormously, and they had modus operandi, which was very disreputable in numerous ways. They abused their powers, and so they withheld themselves out of existence. Now, they didn't withhold themselves out of existence. They couldn't withhold themselves. They reduced themselves out of existence. All right, technically speaking, then there'd be two ways to get rid of your abilities. Two ways. Just withhold their use or reduce them out of sight. And these are the only two things that a pre-clear has done. There is no other mechanism involved. Just clear the decks because there isn't any other mechanism there. Now, one of the ways of withholding one's abilities is by getting an identity which one would ruin if he demonstrated bad abilities. Famous identities come to some way or another in this category. A famous identity is capable of doing a great deal in the society, you see. And then he finds out perhaps that he's doing too much. So when he ceases to be a famous identity, you see, he buries it very, very deeply because he wouldn't particularly want to carry on doing these things but not backed up by the identity or regulated by the identity. An identity is a regulator more than anything else. It's a sort of a police method against yourself. Now, knowledge, then, is determined by one's ability to control, which is determined by one's ability to be selectively capable of judgment, which is to say, responsibility. Responsibility is selectivity in the exercise of judgment. Judgment, one uses judgment if he is responsible. And of course, he can be responsible without having used judgment. And so the selectivity he exercises in handling judgment, whether it's good judgment or bad judgment or no judgment and so forth, this is responsibility. So we have this triangle. It's a very valuable triangle. You want to know why somebody doesn't know about something. It's because he can't control himself with regard to that subject, so he is being totally irresponsible for it by not knowing about it, you see. But then, nevertheless, it disappears out of sight, he hopes. And it's gone. There's that triangle of knowledge, control, and responsibility, and that is a very, very important triangle. If you want to get somebody to know about something, you will have to increase their control, and you will have to increase their responsibility, their selectivity of judgment. Those two points are most important parts of those two points of control and responsibility are withhold and permitting cause. You can substitute for control if you want the most important part of the control. You can substitute there ability to withhold on own determinism. That's the most important part of control. And because when that one goes, well, the rest of the control is gone, you see. And when that one's rehabilitated, then control comes back. So you see the difference here. And then as far as responsibility is concerned, well, a person finds out he cannot exercise judgment in causing things. Why, he decides then that he's irresponsible, doesn't have responsibility for it, he won't do it, and the reduction of ability is under the head of responsibility. If you want to recover an ability, you'd better raise responsibility. If you want to get the person to exercise the ability, you had better recover his ability to withhold. And between the two, you will recover knowledge. Now, just recovering knowledge can, in some fashion, shift these other two points. We have a senior ARC triangle at work here. You can shift a person's ability to control, and all of a sudden he knows all about it. Therefore, you can take a motorcycle out and start it, stop it, and change it, you see, reach and withdraw, fool around with the darn thing, and the next thing you know how the motor works, but you didn't even look at the motor. You get the idea? Of course, you've known how the motors work for ages. You've already known this for a very long time. And now, the reason a kid busts up motorcycles and so forth is because the responsibility factor isn't high enough, you see. Well, actually, his control factor isn't high enough, and his knowledge factor isn't high enough. Well, they can tack this from any one of the three sides. You can get a person to study the motorcycle, to study motorcycles, and have them go on studying motorcycles. It's very funny, though, because that's a weak button. That's the button the society uses most, but it's the weakest button. It's the strongest recovery button. You see, I mean, when a person knows about something, it blows. It's the strongest recovery button, but it's the weakest entrance button. You got the idea? Just finding out about something doesn't rehabilitate one's control or one's responsibility to any great degree. You see? The weakest attack point would simply be education. Oddly enough. Although it's the monitoring button, it's the weakest attack point. A person just will refuse to know about something unless he has some guarantee he'll be able to withhold it and some guarantee that he can be responsible for what he causes in that particular field. Now, you could take some little kid, the way they work at it, to re-educate little children. I'll give you an idea, you know. Here you are, you lose a body, you pick up another body, you find yourself in school studying arithmetic. What are you studying arithmetic for? Well, of course, it was all part of the package you just lost and submerged, so your knowledge is gone because you couldn't withhold this body from death. By the way, the biggest withhold you do is withholding the body from death. And when a body dies, you decide you couldn't withhold it from death. In a battle, for instance, you would kill people. You see, you'd kill people in a battle. Every time you kill somebody in a battle, you withhold your own death. And that you do instinctively, you see. When you're in an automobile accident, why, you might worsen it for the other fellow, but you withhold your own death from the automobile accident, you see. Now, people who are unable to withhold their own death die off rather easily and bury it very deep. But it's a loss. Not from a standpoint of losing an item, but it's a loss from the standpoint of win-lose. Now, responsibility, deteriorated responsibility, will bring about some dramatic inability to withhold. If you deteriorate somebody's responsibility very rapidly, this fellow's, where you say, this must have been a good man, he was in charge of the Northern Malaysian Confederation or something of the sort, and he lost his post. So you say, well, you hire him, and you find out he's an alcoholic, you know, and he's just drunk, and he can't keep his hands out of the till, and the idea, you deteriorated his responsibility, and of course his control deteriorated, and you say, well, he was so successful at government, so therefore he must know quite a bit about government, you find out he's forgotten everything he knew. Got the idea? You've seen this happen in one lifetime. Well, it happens over the cycle of lives. Now, it's quite important in a case to recognize that you could take a child on arithmetic and get him to cause problems in arithmetic, you see? Cause arithmetic. We can get him solve any problems. That's a totally backwards piece of nonsense. That's the way they do it, you see, in school. This is not the way to teach arithmetic. The way to teach arithmetic would be to have the child make up problems that it was all right for him to make up. He'd be writing down 1 plus 1 equals 2, you know. 1 plus 1, oh boy, that's a problem. And then you'd get him to make up 23 plus 27, he'd say, no, that's going to cause somebody trouble. So he can't make that much of a problem. You'd have to bring him up on a gradient scale of making up problems. You make him cause arithmetic. Got the idea? Take responsibility for this subject called arithmetic by causing it. And then move him around so that he can withhold doing arithmetic. See, he either does arithmetic or not does arithmetic on his own determinism. Now, if you did those 2 points only, he would all of a sudden know all about arithmetic and be a very good arithmetician. But notice that the 2 lower points of the triangle are consistently violated by modern education. All they want the child to do is put down solutions, making him the effect of arithmetic. And they make him do arithmetic on the teacher's determinism, not on the child's determinism, which of course makes him reverse-wise on the subject of arithmetic. So it's no wonder they go to school these days until they're 152 or whatever the age is. You could probably take a child and teach him all he needed to know about arithmetic or money or anything else by taking the 2 lower buttons and achieving knowledge. In other words, you'd have him take responsibility for it, however you did that. Responsibility for the subject. And then on the other button, why, you'd let him start change and stop arithmetic. You might be able to do that by having him take a paper with a lot of arithmetic problems on it and simply shove it around the desk. Start, change, and stop it, don't you think? There'd be a lot of solutions that we have in Scientology that could be applied to rehabilitating a knowledge of arithmetic. But the result of, over here on one corner, responsibility increase, and the result of the control increase would be knowledge. Now, just educate him again into arithmetic is very simple, and of course it's the master button, it's the one that's evidently dedicated, and this would be the right button, providing he didn't already know arithmetic. So that is the bug that modern education hides from itself, is that they haven't got anybody there who doesn't already know their subject matter, sometimes much better than the teacher or the professor. See, because the knowledge button is messed up, you'd have to enter it from the other 2 corners. And so it is with the life of any preclic. have a striking example of this educational aspect, a very striking example of it, on which I have very definite subjective reality, because I hate to confess it to you, but I couldn't learn navigation back in the 30s. I just couldn't learn navigation. I would sit down and I would read a textbook on navigation. I might as well have been reading blank pages. So before this had gone on very long, because I was interested in expeditions and I had to take my Master Mariner's examination sooner or later, I just said, well, there's only one thing left for me to do, and that's to evolve the science of navigation. So I sat down and evolved navigation, what would be a science of navigation. Went ahead merrily and found out I could solve all the problems they gave me on the subject of navigation after that, and skipped it. Took my examination, got a good mark in the examination, got in the Navy, navigated ships, never laid any up on the rocks and so forth, and I was going along just fine. So one day I was standing at a chart table as flag navigator, and Admiral walks in. He looks over some of the work I'm doing there. And he says, well, that's amazing. That's amazing. I see that you're using the Royal Method. And I said, well, is that right? Yes, he says, well, how did you ever get it out here in the combat area? It's just been released. Well, we have our ways and means, I said. You know, carrier pigeons and all that, sir. But when in the course of playing hooky down through the trillennia, you have consistently gotten tangled up with marine affairs and have consistently been navigating, and you've been navigating not with Polaris and all of that sort of thing, but under various skies and so on. It's not actually even a frequent activity of mine, just every once in a while, why ships look good or piracy pays well. You know, and I play hooky. Well, inevitably, you've got to learn navigation. One of the reasons you learn navigation is very simple, is the crew never murders the only man that can get them back to port. And I'd just gotten to a point where every 1,000 years or something like that, I'd learned navigation for the last umpteen trillennia, you see. I just gotten to a point where I couldn't study it anymore. It was the most amazing phenomenon you ever saw. Just sit there and have a whole page of navigation just wipe out. Whether it was Dreizenstock or Adjutant or Dutton or Bowditch or anything else, I might as well have been looking at just blank paper. Nothing made any sense at all. Well, how does this compare to your PC? See, I'm just taking one isolated, goofy subject, which means nothing to me. I don't even consider it a particularly prideful skill. As a matter of fact, I fixed that old Admiral, by the way. I had a couple of goldfish bowls. I never use chronometers anymore. I stole a couple of aircraft watches off some pilots in the Army that were careless enough to come aboard. The chronometers, the old Navy chronometers, didn't work, so I had them taken out and stowed. And there were there's a great big bins on the chart table there. So I got goldfish bowls, and I put them in these big bins, you see, and put a light down below to light them up, you know, crystal balls, of course, you know. And one day this old admiral wandered down into my chart room. They always haunt chart rooms. They like to recollect their days as a midshipman, you know. And he wandered in, and he wanted to know the position. Well, the funny part of it was, is one of the gags is the LORAN navigation system was underneath one of these crystal balls. And, of course, it was just two dials of latitude and longitude, and lighted in such a way you could only see it through the crystal ball. And he wanted to know what the latitude and longitude was, and so I lean over and look at one of these crystal balls from his viewpoint, you see, just a lighted crystal ball. He took one look at this mystic, spiritual, magical hangover, you know. It was just a joke for the quartermasters and the officers of the watch, you know. Mangotti goes right up and sees the captain, you know, and turns in a report on me. I decided after that I'd better study and find out what a sense of humor was, because ours were differed. I just wanted to show you a specialized piece of knowledge. You see, a specialized piece of knowledge, a rather goofball piece of knowledge, that gets you to sail on flat planes, apparently, around actual spheres, navigating by various types and stars and gimmicks and gahoojits and all that sort of thing. And sailing through space at infinite distances at a speed too fast to pick up the light from the stars you were leaving, you see. All kinds of weird things, and jamming up the stars you're approaching. And it's quite a complicated subject. Astrogation is something they haven't solved yet here, and they're not about to for a long time, because they haven't got enough bright boys this time who themselves are willing to redevelop it. They think they're going to have to study it. The way to ruin them navigationally would be write a textbook on astrogation, not let anybody evolve it, see? All right. Now, just let's take this subject, which none of us have as a button, I'm sure. Let's just take this subject and realize that the PC looks over the pages of his past, and he simply finds them blank. Smudged here and there, maybe. Maybe peculiarities here and there, the way they stick together or something. But it's just a blank book. In fact, it's a whole blank library. And in that is practically every subject known and unknown to man. Your PC is a textbook on ceramics, swordcraft, how to build huts, houses, palaces, skyscrapers, how to manufacture tools, how to make up electronics this way and electronics that way. How to be a housewife, how not to be a housewife. How to be a chatelaine, how to be a notch girl. How to be an empress. How to coif one's hair in the up mode and the up mode and the walk mode. How to allure and align. How to cheer men up and spin them in. How to dress and undress. All these are vast subjects. They're very vast subjects. The subject of cosmetics alone would make you laugh every time you see a little teenage kid buying her first lipstick. That's silly. She wants to know how to put it on. And she always puts it on wrong. Well, here's experience. Here's the interweave and interlock of good luck and bad luck and depravity and majesty, all mixed up in the same potpourri. And that's what all these textbooks, your PC, is about. That's what they're all about. I mean, they're just ad infinitum. The administration of matriarchies, the care and management of temples, religion as a methodology of control to a recalcitrant people, He just runs on and on, see? Been a smart man for a long time. One of his primary pieces of smartness, he thinks, until a method comes along by which he can withhold some of the things he's caused in the past, the smartest smartness of which he is capable is to be stupid about that whole textbook. He just remains good and stupid about that thing. If he keeps all those pages good and blank, well, he's got it made. He's a library with all the pages not his. And the least person that would find out about it is the PC. Now, you can find out about it as an auditor because you act as more or less an automatic withhold to the PC. He's willing to tell you things to the degree that you slam him back in the auditing chair every time he bolts. Look at that as why control mechanisms work. Look at that as why the CCHs work. Look at that as why hand space mimicry, which is all put up a barrier, more or less, why this stuff works. The auditor's operating as an automatic control mechanism that the PC cannot influence or determine. And his confidence in the auditor and his ability to tell the auditor things is in direct ratio to the amount of control he thinks the auditor will clamp on him. So he knows if he starts growing astray and eating empresses or something, well, the auditor's sitting right there to slam him back on the subject, you see? So with some confidence, he can then plow into his psyche. But with an auditor whose control is limp, slack, bleh, no, he isn't going to divulge much. For him to regain enough control requires, as the entering wedge, control of him. For him to regain enough responsibility to get anywhere requires responsibility for him. For him to regain any knowledge of anything requires, on the auditor's point, more knowledge of the situation than the PC has. So if the auditor is senior on all three points of this triangle, to the PC in session, you, of course, have a very rapid session. But given an irresponsible auditor, or symptoms of irresponsibility in the auditor, and you get no forward push by the PC. PC says, I don't know. I think at one time or another, it does seem to me, looking at this sort of thing here, I used to pick people's teeth rather deeply with a scimitar. The auditor says, yes, go on. Well, that's the end of the tale of the scimitar. Because the auditor apparently was taking no responsibility for the scimitar. Somebody starts playing around with scimitars, the PC knows he can't take responsibility for a scimitar. He's liable to cause anything with a scimitar. He's liable to behead slaves, mamelukes, soldiers, sailors, mistresses, and empresses with scimitars. Just give him one scimitar and he goes amok. He knows that. Down deep someplace, he knows that. He knows he's not a man to be trusted with a scimitar. He's got some idea of what the auditor'd have to do to withhold for him in case he did start running amok with a scimitar. And if the auditor says, well, yes, he's a man. This person isn't being responsible enough. He interprets it as interest, by the way. Person isn't being responsible enough. for scimitars, for me to have any more to do with them at this point, so the knowledge of it just goes out of sight. But any of you every once in a while had a PC's facsimiles turn off. Bing. Well, he feels he's already gone too far, and he conceives the auditor to be irresponsible for the situation and unwilling to control the session. And to a lesser degree, that the auditor doesn't know his business. I mean, this is a less monitoring factor than you'd think. You could take an auditor who was apparently very, very stupid, had far less knowledge, let us say, of Scientology, but who did a technically accurate job of control and took responsibility for what was going on, and you'd have a session. So the wrong direction for you to go to be a good auditor, you see, is to keep exhibited just back of your head numerous textbooks by me. See? The right way to go is to yourself pick up your control ability and your willingness to take responsibility for what, not only for the session, but what's going on in the session. And if your control is good and your responsibility is good, you can pick up knowledge on the way. Don't try doing it reverse-wise. You know, before you exert any control and before you take any responsibility, let's know all there is to know. Well, of course, you'll never that way find out anything because you're not causing a session. You see, and the PC isn't going to divulge anything to you at all. The PC isn't going to tell you anything. You wonder why PCs, why they just absolutely vomit data at some auditors, you know, and they say, I just remember vividly, oh, that's, what do you know, and they, gee whiz, you know, and holy cats, that's what we did with dancing girls. Well, when us senior dancing girls found the junior dancing girls were getting the eye from the wrong balcony up there, well, those fountains, that's why I keep having a picture of those fountains. He drowned them. Now, that's why. And you say, well, I'll pick up the same incident and run it from there and flatten it up. And you say to the PC, doesn't have any trust yet in your responsibility for the session. You say, what about these fountains? The PC says, what fountains? Or you have an ARC break and the phenomenon, which you've all seen, I'm sure, of a facsimile folding up, or a case that was running fairly well just absolutely stopped running well at the point of an ARC break. Well, all an ARC break really is, you know, you're too prone to interpret an ARC break as the auditor ceased to play upon the violin and make sweet music, you know. You know, all must be calm and happy. That's ARC. That's nothing to do with ARC. ARC in a session is best aided and assisted by taking a maximal amount of control. Control. PC breathes wrong way, you know. You know you got a case that's a very rough case. You can just start applying control, you know. You can just actually start handling the PC's hands. You control the position of the cans. You say, I want those cans held upright, have the backs of the hands against the knees and both feet flat on the floor. That's the way I want them. PC does anything else, you just reach over and put his hands into that proper position. PC starts to go down, and he said, no, hold your head up during the session. Now, don't you be alarmed or upset after what I've told you here, that the PC all of a sudden starts knowing all about his case. But you'd say that's entirely contrary to social ARC. No, you apply control to the session, you take responsibility for the session, and your PC sings like a canary. There's where the music should come from, not from the audience. The auditor can play the anvil chorus as long as he plays it in even vaguely acceptable rhythm. And he'll find out all about the case. Now, what I'm telling you is, matter of fact, been a a mystery for a long time. They're just falling out of the hopper, so you get the benefit of the data. We knew cases folded up on an ARC break and wouldn't run. But what, from the pre-clear's viewpoint, was an ARC break? What really made an ARC break? Drop of responsibility or inadequacy of control. Those were the two high points. Those were the two high points. A lower point, and not often does this one come up. The PC didn't know, the auditor didn't know his business. But almost any auditor knows his business well enough to rattle off the auditing command and start sessions and stop sessions and run rudiments and that sort of thing. Certainly an auditor knows his business that far. He might not know the last word in theory or something like that, but if he just knows his business that far, that's about all as far as he has to go. He knows the right command and he knows what he's looking for. And you would be utterly amazed what an auditor can get done who doesn't practically know anything, but who just controls the living daylights of a PC, takes full responsibility for the session, you know. They're not just tricks, but if a door slams a block away and the PC goes like that in my auditing chair, I apologize to him for the door slamming. I'm responsible for the environment, see? There are various mechanisms of this character. The team next to you, you see, suddenly starts screaming or fighting or something of the sort. Stop taking it up with the PC as to whether or not it bothered him. You're the one that says whether or not it bothered him. What you take up with a PC is you're sorry you have to continue to audit him in that environment, but here we go. Is it a different viewpoint? It's your environment. You're sorry they're having a fight. But that's it. You're going to carry on. When your PC seems to be getting awfully stupid, toughen up your control. Simple as that. These are the tricks of the trade. Toughen up your control. I've been doing these things for years and so forth, and a lot of auditing has come out of studying what I was doing. Well, it wasn't that I was being automatic or something of the sort or operating from some vast, inarticulated well. It's just that I happen to be getting results. But I have been remiss from time to time and been sorry for it on control. Once in a blue moon, my PC, I felt sorry for the PC. It was just the session had been so chopped up and battered up by factors not under anybody's immediate direct control. PC had decided that he just had it, you see, and I'd give him a break. I've been sorry every time I've ever done it over the many, many 13 years. Been real sorry. Now that's the time to stiffen up the control and show him you're in control of the session. Now once in a while, a PC will tell you that you've been a little pushy or a little bit shovy or a little bit invalidative or a little bit this or a little accusative. The only thing he's trying to do is squirm sideways on you trying to make him guilty of overt acts. And you realize when you run overt acts out of the PC that he can reinterpret it that you're trying to make him guilty of overt acts, which is the primary overt act. Well, you better ease that one off in a hurry. But if he's sensitive about being made guilty of overt acts, then something in the session, usually, rather than in the auditing session, something in the case, you've hit something in the case where he's trying to make somebody guilty of overt acts. So when you ask him for an overt, He thinks you're trying to make him guilty of an overt act, right? See that? Guilty of overt acts. Now, one of your prime mechanisms is, who would that make guilty of an overt act? Would it make anybody else guilty of an overt act? Any other people would be made guilty of an overt act by that? Is there anything in that session, or anything that's happening to you in that incident there, or whatever you're running, see, would make people guilty of an overt act? All of a sudden, the person takes his service facsimile and drops it in your lap, see? There he was, using it in that incident. And there he is, staggering, thirsty, and forlorn, an abandoned legionnaire across the sands of Africa, you see. Deserted by his commanders, harassed on every side by Arabs. Finished. And to this day, he can feel the sand in his throat. Well, a crass and callous statement on your part. Well, how would that make guilty of an overt act? You know, that's not called for. You got to be smooth. You got to be smooth. You better do it than not do it. See, even if you do it rough, but you better be fairly smooth about it. And you say, well, was there any possibility that you had anything to do with getting yourself in that situation? Was there any possibility of this? I'm not accusing you of this, you understand? But how'd you fix yourself up that way? Is there a possibility that you did fix yourself up that way? Just testing it on for size, you know? Oh, well, let's see, you know, you'll consider that. Consider that, and said, oh, no, actually, no, I didn't fix myself up in any way like that. Nope, there I was, walking across the desert, staggering, betrayed by my officers, and ever since I've had this feeling of sand in my throat. This is the reverse. He's making somebody guilty of an overt act when it doesn't release on his causation. Of course, he's always trying to make, in these incidents, somebody guilty of an overt act, but that can be lesser. In this particular case of the hanged-up somatic, the one that won't release at all, he's, of course, working at it overtime. He won't admit to any overts at all. Well, you've got another way of pulling the rug out from underneath him along about that point. Who would that make guilty? And if it's a really stuck one, and if he's really been insistent on it, instead of flashing back in your face, he'll level. One of the smartest lines in book one, by the way, was, if you can just parallel what the mind is doing, you got it made. That's true. And in that particular case, he's trying to make somebody guilty of an overt act. So he says, oh, guilty of an overt act. The Arabs, my officers, the Roman Senate, the Roman system, the Roman army, the legion, the colonel of the regiment, the cohort, everything, this, that, so forth. Other people. Give them a chance to run off automaticities, by the way. Your repetitive auditing command of insisting on only one answer at a time sometimes doesn't cope with an automaticity. You can always say, well, give me a few of them. You know, and it just fires off. Brr. You say, how's the sand in your throat? The sand in my throat? What sand? Oh, the sand in my throat. All right, would it make me guilty of an overt act? Well, it sure would, putting me into that incident again. As a matter of fact, I just happened to think, you know, I caused the mutiny that caused the disbanding of that cohort. What do you know? I just remembered that. I wonder why I didn't think of that before. I'm afraid that was the case. Of course, there were other ringleaders, and I was just one of the fellows. And you get him back up to a point where he caused the mutiny, and that's why it's all about. See? And that's how that thing will fall apart. But actually, it won't fall apart if he is still panic-stricken on the subject of withholds. If he's afraid he will continue to mutiny against any military organization he has anything to do with, he won't hardly even know about the incident. So, you've got your other angle of attack is, you've got it right there, a military organization or whatever it reacted to, or you could even take a specialized terminal. We don't much care how you do this because you're not going to run it ad nauseum, you know, as a repetitive command forever. You're just going to rehabilitate for that little particular section of time. You're going to rehabilitate his ability to withhold against that cohort or against those officers, whatever was banging on the meter, you see. And you say, well, what could you withhold from Legion officers? And he's liable to think for a long time, think he was in Africa, and ICE would be in Greenland or something. So he could probably, and they didn't know about Greenland, and he didn't know about Greenland either at that time. So therefore, it's safe to say that he could withhold a piece of Greenland from the Legion officers. Now, he'll go on that gradient scale, all of a sudden rehabilitate his ability to withhold, and you'll find out that this bird has been killing officers for a very, very long time. That's his first action in battle. First action in battle, he says, well, this time, he said these centurions here are pretty good, and everything's pretty good, and this time I'm going to be a good boy, and not like I was in the Phoenician army, you know, but I'm going to be a good boy this time, and so on. I'm going to get along with these fellows. I'm going to be a model of a good soldier and everything, and he gets into battle, and they're all rushing forward, and there's the exposed back of a centurion. His sword goes right straight through and bang. And he said, how did that sword move into the back of that centurion? That's the mystery. Who did it? This is one of the reasons men start thinking up about ghosts and devils and things that go boom in the night. That's why they have Athena soaring over the battle, giving victory to one side or the other. See, she could always direct your sword arm to do the wrong thing. That kind of thing, you know. And this little girl, she's going to be a model housewife. She's just going to be an absolutely model housewife. That's all. She's going to be a model housewife. Now, she's got it made. You know, she's got it made. She's married the Baron. And they've got this perfectly nice place, and she's socially acceptable, and it's all okay. She's respected, got a lot of responsibility in the area, if she'll just take it. And if she can just keep from dropping ground glass or arsenic in it, the porridge, why, she's got me. And way down deep someplace, she's sort of chanting to herself, I will not drop ground glass in the porridge. You see, I will not drop ground glass in the porridge. Because he's a nice fellow. He's good in bed. Everything's fine. He'll have lots of children and everything else. And one day, he comes home and he's dirty and smelly from a campaign. And he throws his boots and so forth all over the hall. And he goes up the room and he's got a 4-week growth of beard. And he hasn't bathed forever. And he gives her a kiss, you know, and happens to glance in the bedroom and finds a pair of men's boots in there, and it doesn't matter that they were a present for him, you see. He soars, you know, and he says, why, you liberal, and you mustn't do things like this in my absence, and threatens the chastity belt and all that sort of thing. Nice little scramble there, you know. Routine, nothing very important. She goes downstairs. She looks at her hands and says, help me, Pete, they're grounding up ground glass. And she said, well, I'll just put it by just in case, you see. That's safe, you see, and it moves right straight over and pours itself in the porridge, and that's that. She's a widow. Of course, don't be surprised if very short time later in the incident, why, she slips at the top of the castle steps and falls down 196 steps and busts her neck. That was an accident. Don't be surprised if for the next 162,000 years she has nothing whatsoever to do with marriage. Don't be surprised if her difficulty here in present time, as you will find in trying to straighten up the present life, is that all a man can do anything he wants to her. You know, he can slap her and cuff her or kick her or feed her to the lions or hand her over to the boyfriend or one of his friends, or it doesn't matter. But all he does is say, "You're a cute kid, let's get married," and she goes nuts. And she just can't understand it. That one she has no knowledge about. She knows she's lived just one life. There's no causation in this life to explain that. Her father and mother apparently didn't do too badly together. And you can go looking endlessly for this particular foible. You're not going to find it. Unless you start running something on the order of what could you withhold from a husband? All of a sudden, here's sprays of ground glass going out. She just can't do anything with it. See? Now, this is the story of man. This is the story of woman. This is the story of how they get along. When they lose the ability to withhold against certain terminals, they don't have anything to do with them. And when they eventually discover that they can't even vaguely, even not have anything to do with them, you know, they have to associate with them and so on, well, then they just lose all ability to do anything in that direction. They can't take any responsibility, they don't know anything about it, and so forth. They blow themselves off at the least provocation, and so on. And they're in some terrific randomness that they themselves can't explain. Well, you can explain it. They've lost their ability to withhold. They can't take responsibility. First, they can't take responsibility for causing things. Then they realize they've lost their ability to withhold. So they fall out totally on association, memory, knowledge. Everything else goes by the board. This is all you've got to rehabilitate in the case, and you got it made. And that's what you're doing in this unit. Thank you.